Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Biological Children and Social Security Child Survivor Benefits Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 19, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Astru v. Capato. The question in this case is whether twins who were conceived in vitro after the death of their biological father and who cannot inherit their father's personal property under state law are nevertheless eligible for Social Security Child Survivor Benefits. To discuss the case, we have Adam White, who is counsel at the Washington law firm Boyd & Gray & Associates. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. White.
Technological revolutions often cast old laws in new light. Perhaps the best example of this, the Fourth Amendment. This year, in United States v. Jones, the Supreme Court grappled with whether police officers violate the Fourth Amendment by using modern GPS satellite technology to track suspects. A decade ago, in Kelo v. United States, the court considered police officers' use of new thermal imaging technology to spy through the walls of drug dealers' homes. And much earlier in the 20th century, the court considered whether wiretapping a suspect's home, back then an innovative surveillance technique, was a search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment. First, the court held that wiretapping wasn't a search or seizure in 1928. 4 decades later, they reversed themselves. Of course, the Constitution is not the only law affected by technological change. A federal statute passed by Congress long ago to solve yesteryear's problems might fail to answer questions raised by new technology today. 2 years ago, in Bilski v. Capos, the Supreme Court was asked to determine whether the Patent Act protected math formulas used by commodities traders, a previously incomprehensible question. And now, breakthroughs in reproductive technology raise no less difficult questions, this time under the Social Security Act. Last week, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Astru v. Capato, case number 11-159. The court considered a question unfathomable to the Social Security Act's creators 80 years ago. Namely, if a baby is conceived after the death of his biological father, using sperm cells donated by the father while still alive, is the baby eligible for so-called child survivor benefits under the Social Security Act? The facts of Astru v. Capato are fascinating, although, as I'll explain later, they're increasingly common. We'll turn to those in a moment. But first, let's begin not with the facts of the case, but with the law. In 1939, Congress amended the Social Security Act to provide benefits to dependent minor children of deceased wage earners. Under that version of the law, a child is eligible for benefits, and the term child was, then and now, the key term. Unfortunately, the Act defined child rather broadly and circularly. A child is, quote, the child of an individual, as well as certain stepchildren or adopted children. Promptly after the law's enactment in the 1940 regulation, the Social Security Administration interpreted that part of the Act as requiring the agency to look to state law, namely, the law of intestacy, or wills and estates, to determine whether a given person was a decedent's child eligible for federal benefits. In 1965, Congress amended that law in response to changing times. Not the biotech revolution, of course, but rather the crucial social trend of the day, out-of-wedlock birth. Congress retained the previous provisions regarding state law and the definition of a child, but it added that descendants not qualified as children under state law would still be eligible for federal benefits if the father had acknowledged the child in writing, had been ordered by the court to contribute to the child support, or had been judicially decreed to be the child's father. Well, that's basically where the law stands today. Now as then, the Social Security Administration reads the law as requiring it to ascertain whether the child qualifies as a, quote, child under state law in order to determine whether he qualifies for federal benefits. In most cases, this is not a controversial question, whether in the case of children born naturally to married parents or to children born out of wedlock or to adopted children or to children conceived through in vitro fertilization and born to living parents. But the case before the Supreme Court now, Astru v. Capato, presents very different circumstances. Nick and Karen Capato met in the 1990s in Seattle, Washington. They moved around a bit from Washington to Colorado to Florida. They were married in New Jersey in 1999. But that same year, Mr. Capato was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. Warned by doctors that chemotherapy might leave him sterile, he soon began depositing sperm at an in vitro fertilization clinic in Florida, where the Capatos were living. His health improved, and a couple of years later, Mrs. Capato gave birth to a naturally conceived son. But then Mr. Capato's condition worsened again, and the Capatos feared that their son would never have a sibling. so they refocused their efforts on in vitro options. They instructed their attorney to provide for unborn children on equal footing with their living son, although no such provision was added to Mr. Capato's will. Mr. Capato passed away in 2002 at the age of 44. Mrs. Capato soon began in vitro fertilization treatments, and 18 months after Mr. Capato died, Mrs. Capato gave birth to twins, Mr. Capato's biological children. Immediately after the twins were born, Mrs. Capato applied on their behalf to the federal government for Social Security survivor benefits. The Social Security Administration denied her claim. On rehearing, an administrative law judge affirmed that denial. Mrs. Capato appealed to the U.S. District Court for the District of New Jersey. She filed suit there rather than in Florida because she and her husband had generally planned to move there. But the District Court affirmed the administration's denial benefits, holding that the Social Security Act based survivor benefits on whether the twins were Mr. Capato's children under state law, and that the laws of Florida, the Capato's residence, did not deem babies conceived after the father's death to be the father's children. But the Third Circuit unanimously reversed and sided with the Capatos. It opened its opinion by conceding that, quote, "It goes without saying that these technologies were not within the imagination, much less the contemplation, of Congress when the relevant sections of the Social Security Act came to be, and that they present a host of difficult legal and even moral questions." The court added, "This is indeed a new world." Yet the Third Circuit concluded that its decision would not turn on those difficult new legal and moral questions. Indeed, the court concluded that the law was pretty straightforward. Because the government did not dispute that the Capato twins were Mr. Capato's biological offspring, the court concluded that they automatically qualified as children, eligible for Social Security survivor benefits. The government petitioned the Supreme Court for review, and the court agreed to hear the case. The cert briefs illustrated how the facts of the Capato case are increasingly common. In fact, multiple circuit courts have heard similar cases, giving rise to a circuit split on the benefits question. In 2004, the Ninth Circuit heard a strikingly similar case involving twins conceived by a widow several months after the biological father's death by cancer. That court, like the Third Circuit in Astru, held that the twins were the deceased father's children for purposes of the Social Security Act. The Fourth Circuit, years later, heard a case in which a baby was conceived 6 years after the apparent father's death. It held, in a decision issued just 3 months after Capato from the Third Circuit, that the baby did not qualify as an eligible child under the Social Security Act. And just 3 weeks after the government filed its cert petition in Capato, the Eighth Circuit entered the fray, agreeing with the Fourth Circuit and the Social Security Administration. And let me add an interesting bit of trivia. The Eighth Circuit opinion was written by Judge Stephen Colleton. The hospital at the center of that case, the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, was directed for 20 years by John Colleton, Judge Colleton's father. There's an entire wing in the hospital named after the Colleton family. The Circuit Court's opinions are just the tip of the biotech iceberg. The government cert petition asserted that the Social Security Administration has received more than 100 applications for survivor benefits for posthumously conceived babies, and the rate has been increasing significantly in recent years. Now that we've traced the case history and context, let's cut to the chase, namely the specific legal issue before the court. The Social Security Act survivorship provision, 42 U.S.C. 402D, grants benefits to every child of an eligible deceased wage earner, so long as the child is minor or disabled and was dependent upon the deceased wage earner at the time of his death. The key word there for our purposes is child, and for the definition of child, the statute points to Section 416E. Unfortunately, Section 416E doesn't shed a lot of new light on the subject. Instead, it's basically circular. It defines, quote, child as, quote, the child or legal adopted child of an individual. In other words, a child is a child. But a later subsection, 416H, adds an important detail. Quote, "In determining whether an applicant is the child of a deceased wage earner, the government shall apply such law as would be applied in determining the devolution of intestate personal property by the courts of the state in which the wage earner had been domiciled." In other words, 416H bases the definition of child on the applicable state law of the relevant state. This is what the government points to in supporting its interpretation that state law governs whether a given applicant is an eligible child. But the Capatos argue, and the Third Circuit held, that that last provision is altogether irrelevant where the babies in question are indisputably the biological offspring of the deceased father who had been married to the biological mother. And so the court must decide, does Section 416H's reference to state law apply in all cases, or is child self-explanatory and self-executing when the baby is the biological offspring of married parents? At oral argument, several justices seriously questioned whether Section 416H's state law reference actually applies in all cases, and in large part, their doubts owed to the fact that that provision actually appears to put children on less secure footing than grandchildren or stepchildren. The latter categories are not explicitly tied to state law. Does this mean that all grandchildren and stepchildren are eligible beneficiaries, but children can qualify only on a state-by-state basis? That doesn't make a lot of sense. Furthermore, tying children's benefits to state law would give states immense control over a federal program. At the outset of oral argument, Justice Alito posed a hypothetical question. What if one state ended all inheritance rights for children? Would that render all children within the state categorically ineligible for Social Security benefits? Obviously, that's a far-fetched scenario. Still, as the Capatos noted in their merits brief, a primary reason for establishing survivor benefits in the first place was to provide a nationwide program for dependent children who had been insufficiently supported by the patchwork of state programs. It would seem odd to tie that federal program to the same patchwork of state standards. Chief Justice Roberts also noted that tying the survivor benefits to state law might severely complicate the Social Security Administration's work, at least in the new context of posthumous offspring. Many states may not have clear law regarding posthumous survivors, and if Social Security eligibility is tied to state law, then federal regulators will have to try to ascertain what state law is in order to apply it in any given case. A single federal standard would be much more transparent, predictable, and administrable. The government's lawyer repeatedly tried to discredit such an alternative as dreaded federal common law, but compared to state-by-state chaos, some federal common law might not be a bad thing. Still, although Section 416H's reliance on state law might have discordant consequences, the text of the law seems relatively clear. Again, Section 416H states without exception that the administrator shall apply state law in determining whether the applicant is the decedent's child. And for that reason, the court was no less critical of the Capatos' arguments. The Capatos had tried to create a per se category of offspring automatically qualifying as children, namely biological offspring of a married couple. But that last factor, the parent's married status, is found nowhere in the statutory text. True, in 1939, the vast majority of American children were born to married parents. Nevertheless, that factor isn't specified in the statute, and it's difficult to convince the court that the law unambiguously supports your position when your position depends on factors only implicit and not explicit in the text of the statute. And even if the parent's marriage were a relevant statutory consideration, reproductive technology and posthumous conception still complicates things. As Justice Ginsburg noted, it's not evident that a marriage would continue after one spouse's death anyway. And because marriage, especially common law marriage, is a matter of state law, a categorical rule depending on the parent's marriage would still depend on state law. All told, the justices seemed fairly unsatisfied with both sides' interpretation of the law. At the very least, neither party seems to have the statutory text unambiguously on its side. Chief Justice Roberts, along with Justices Scalia, Sotomayor, and Kagan, all seem to indicate that they find the statutory provisions ambiguous, and they probably aren't alone. And Justices Breyer and Ginsburg appeared to lean towards agreeing with the government's position outright, namely, the definition of child will turn on state law. Justice Kagan didn't mince words. She called the statute a mess. And so the most likely outcome may well be the one that Chief Justice Roberts pointed to near the end of arguments, that the court will give Chevron deference to the agency's interpretation of an ambiguous statute and affirm the agency's position on the law. That would be a suitable fix in the short term, but in the long term, responsibility lies with Congress. Congress must grapple with these difficult new ethical issues and update the statute to actually answer the question raised by modern reproductive technology.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.